The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
Okay, holy cow. This is the Eric Metaxas Show. I cannot believe I've never done a show outdoors before. But I'll do almost anything to get to talk to Daryl Strawberry. Daryl, is that really you?
Eric, you here?
Yeah, is this you?
Welcome to doing a show outside. It's pretty cool,
Let me tell you something. My first show out of doors, brother.
It's different,
this
right?
This is amazing. People who are listening, most of the people I think listening to this program will know who Daryl Strawberry is. But there are tons of people who will be listening who will not know who you are. So I'm going to tell them. You are somebody that when anybody was a Mets fan or Yankees fan, like, your name is at the top of the list. So I'm not going to give you credentials now. I'll do that before the interview, so I don't want to embarrass you. I don't want to see you blush. But I do want to let people know that your story really hinges on God. You know Greg Laurie, who is doing this event. We're at Angel Stadium, by the way. I should make that clear. We're at Angel Stadium. It is 6 p.m. California time, 9 p.m. New York time, so I'm starting to lose it already. But we're here for a crusade that Greg Laurie does every year. And when I heard you were going to be here, Daryl, I just said, I want to get your story because it's an amazing story. So where do I even start with you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up right here in Los Angeles, California.
You grew up in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
When did you know that you wanted to be a professional baseball player?
I think when I was young, when I was around 13 years old, 13, 14 years old.
You knew that early?
I knew in the back of my mind because I came from a broken situation, dysfunction situation. My dad was a raging alcoholic, and he used to beat the crap out of me and said I'd never amount to nothing. So I kind of believed it. So my pain led me to my greatness, but my greatness would eventually lead me to my destructive behavior because I never got well on the inside. So when I was 14 years old, I started watching baseball. I started watching the Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds. And then I saw number 14 that played for the Cincinnati Reds, and his name was Pete Rose. And I started really idolizing who he was because he wasn't this, you know, outstanding baseball player, but his effort and his hustle.
You and I are around the same age. You're like a year older than me, so we have the same experience of growing up watching baseball in the 70s. And there's no question, the Big Red Machine, Pete Rose was superhuman, really.
Yeah, because, you know, his uniform was always dirty. And I just thought to myself, that's what a baseball player is supposed to look like.
That's
He's supposed to have a dirty uniform. And you see him diving to bases and head first. And I just thought he was phenomenal. He wasn't better than Bench, Morgan, Perez, all these other guys. But he outplayed and out-hustled everybody. And I thought, wow, I really want to play baseball because this guy's
George
a baseball
Foster.
Player. Yeah, George Foster, too. He was a home run hitter.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm looking at you. I'm sitting here. Anybody who can see you, you look at you and you say, that's not Charlie Hustle. That's a home run hitter. You have the body, rangy, that people would expect you to be a power hitter, that you would play in the outfield, maybe you play first base. I mean, it's interesting that you looked at Pete Rose, and he was the guy that you kind of homed in on.
Yeah, because it was his effort, his hustle,
yeah,
that really stuck to me. And I saw that. I mean, and his passion and his love for playing baseball. Yeah, I eventually go on to be a home run hitter, but I learned to steal bases. I learned to score runs.
Yeah.
You know, I learned to do it all because of watching Pete Rose, the way he played.
What's the most bases you stole in a season?
36, I believe. I went 30-30.
So you were in the fabled club, the 30-30 club, right?
Yeah, I'm in the 30-30 club. I hit 39 home runs, 36 bags, something like that.
Yeah. And what's the most home runs you hit in a season?
39.
I got to say, I mean, you were a phenomenon in your day. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to get, just in case, because it's noisy here, it's hard to hear, but I just want to make sure people understand that you struggled with substance abuse. You were one of the greatest athletes alive. And in the middle of that, you started dealing with the substance abuse. I mean, when did you enter the major leagues?
Well, I entered the major leagues at 1983. I came in, and I was rookie of the year that year. But I struggled way before that.
Already?
You know, yeah, I struggled when I was 14. I was smoking marijuana when I was 14. I was drinking alcohol, Coke 45, when I was 14, 15 years old.
Well, it's one thing to drink and smoke weed. It's another thing to where it's a problem. In other words, a lot of people would think that once you know, your career gets going and stuff, you'd leave it alone, but you did not.
No, it increased. You cross over to the next level. There's so many different levels in professional sports that guys cross over.
I assume that there were other guys on those teams also using drugs as an enhancement.
A lot of guys, we didn't use enhancing drugs, you know, but we used, you know, recreation drugs. You know, I think, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of drinking. Come on, you're playing in New York City.
Yeah.
You become the greatest team playing in New York City in the 80s, the Mets. You know, we're going to win the World Series in 86. We should have won more.
I follow the Mets in the late 70s when they stunk. So by the time we get to the mid-80s, it was like another deal, you know. So you guys,
it was a raw deal when you got to the
era. Can you imagine the late 70s? But let me ask you, though. So you're playing. Most people, as they're watching you, they think everything's fine because you're putting up the numbers. I mean, you're doing a great job on the field.
Well, I'm athletic, strong. You know, I have the mind capacity of being great.
Yeah.
I have the body physique of being great.
Yeah.
And I had the heart of being great. I wasn't afraid. What I mean about that, I wasn't afraid to fail because failure was a part of it. But the inside wasn't great. Everybody could look at me from the outside and say, what's wrong? But I was completely broken on the inside. I was wounded. I mean, my father left me wounded. I think a lot of times people think, Eric, because you make millions of dollars, it's going to make you well. Money's going to make you well. Money's never going to heal you from the wounds that are up on you on the inside. And I was deeply wounded on the inside. And I was searching for my identity. Who am I?
Yeah.
Not as Daryl Strawberry to play for the Mets, Dodgers, Giants, Yankees, but who am I as a man?
Yeah.
And I could never get to that place.
It's amazing what a father can do with the words that he speaks to his kids. And it sounds like your father did a lot of damage.
Yeah, he did a lot of damage. I mean, it is really amazing what a dad can do. And I tell him, I tell kids all the time, you know, I, my own kids, I would never damage them. I always gave them positive affirmation about doing well and being the best that you can be. Because I know what it was like for me when I was 15 and I was broken, but I was dreaming. I'm going to play in the major leagues because I'm going to take care of my mother. He rejected us. He abandoned us. But I'm going to take care of my mom, and I'm going to bring a great life for her. And my sisters thought I was crazy because that's all I used to talk about is I'm going to the major leagues one day and I'm going to be playing.
So you entered the major leagues in 83. Did you start playing for the Mets? I don't remember.
83, I came in. I mean, I was drafted in 1980 by the Mets, number one draft pick. Spent 2.5 years in the minor leagues. I came close to quitting in the minor leagues. And they asked me to give it another year, and I went to Jackson, Mississippi. I became the Texas League MVP. And I became a ball player. I didn't become a man, but I became a ball player.
Right.
And I came up to the big leagues in 83. And my rookie year, my first road trip, a veteran player told me to go back to the bathroom. And there was. I was introduced to cocaine at the age of 21. And he said, welcome to the big leagues, kid. And I thought I had arrived. And they took me out on a road trip that night and took me to a club. And it was girls, drinks, parties.
These are your fellow players.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to fit in. I wanted to be a part of it because you got to remember, my father said I'd never amount to nothing.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to be a part of this, you know, because I felt like he said I wouldn't be anything, and here I turned out to be this major league player at the age of 21.
So let me ask you, you know, you have tremendous success. You take the Mets to their first World Series in 13 years. It's a big deal. It's a great team. At what point did things begin to go south for you? Or was it not showing until you were with the Yankees?
No, it wasn't showing in my days, my early days, you know, playing it with the Mets. You know, I was at 21, I was an alcoholic. And by the time I got to 25, I was addicted to amphetamines. And I could not play unless I were taking amphetamines every night. So you can imagine, you know, the kind of player I became. I became this outstanding player because I'm taking amphetamines, and they kind of like just light my whole light up every night. And I played like that for years. And I drank for years. And had I known how good I was, I'd have took better care of myself. And I didn't. I go on the road, and I'm out all night, and I'm drinking and partying and girls. And,
right. I mean, you'd have to think that that's going to take, even though you're young, you're not going to be optimal if you're doing that every night.
Well, no, you're not. But at that time, you don't think that way.
Right.
And, you know, every young player think, you know, hey,
I know.
I'm Superman. I bounce back and get up the next day. And I've been out all night, and I'm 2 for 3 with...
You're actually proud of the fact that you pushed yourself that hard the night before, and that you're still able to pull it out. It becomes kind of a sixth sense of pride. So what year did you go to the Yankees? I don't remember.
No, I left at the free agent year, and I went to L.A. I came to L.A. in 1991 after I became a free agent. And you would think, I mean, I signed a $20 million contract, but I was miserable when I signed the contract as a free agent. Well, because my marriage was falling apart. I was an alcoholic. I was a womanizer. So I came here to L.A. and signed the biggest contract of my life. And before the season even started, I went to a crusade, a Morcerillo crusade. And that's the first time in 1991 that I heard about this man named Jesus. I went there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Now, how did you end up at a crusade? And I want to go back for a second. So you grew up without God, without the church.
Yeah, I grew up without God, without the church, you know.
So 1991, what are you at that point? You're in your 20s, obviously.
Yeah, late 20s.
Okay, so how do you end up at a Morris Cerullo crusade? I mean, here you are, you're a big ball player. How do you end up at that?
My first wife, her uncle, he was a Christian. And he said, I just want to take you. I'm not going to force anything on you, but... I just want to take you to this crusade.
Well, your marriage was in trouble.
Yes.
And he figured he may have some ideas of how you can turn the corner here, right?
Well, he never told me about it. He said, I just want to take you. It's a big Christian crusade. I says, okay. So I said, yes, I'll go. And I went. And, oh, Eric, every night that I was there, all he talked about was Jesus. And I cried every night. I sat up there. And I had to sign a $20 million contract. Everybody would probably wonder, what is wrong with him? He should be so happy. But I was weeping every night, had with my head down as he was preaching and talking about the gospel.
That is amazing. And where was that crusade?
It was in Anaheim Convention Center.
So very close to where we are now.
Yeah, it was very close. And I never forget it. I always remember it because I remember Sunday when he said he was going to lay hands on everybody who wanted to, you know, be free. And I remember Sunday I walked down and he laid hands on me and the power of God came over me.
Now, when you say that, a lot of times Christians say these things. I always want to say, stop for a second. What do you mean when you say the power of God?
The power of God came over me like I could not. I mean, I've never experienced anything like it. The power of God came over me. I was speaking immediately in tongues. My belly was flowing like a river after he laid hands on me. And this guy picked me up and he says, I don't know who you are. One of his guys, he said, but God has called you. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, he sounds just like my mother, because my mother said God has called me.
Is that right?
To preach the gospel.
Are you serious? This is incredible. See, I didn't know this. Look,
a lot of people don't.
And we're sitting here. I know you've said it before, but there's so many people. This is why I would want to get to interview you, because there's many people that are listening now. They've never heard your story.
Yes.
And it's strange that we are sitting here in Anaheim Stadium, in a huge baseball stadium. We're here in what's supposed to be the bullpen. And, you know, people tonight are going to have their lives changed by Jesus. People tomorrow night are going to have lives changed by Jesus. People Sunday night are going to... I'm going to get to pray on that stage on Sunday night. So that kind of stuff is going to happen here. But you're telling me in 1991, it happened to you, and you actually felt the Spirit of God touch you. Because a lot of people don't get that. A lot of people, it's an intellectual thing.
Yeah.
But you felt the power of God, and you said you start speaking in tongues.
Yeah, I'm not intellectual. You know, I'm supernatural. I was touched by God. The power of God came over me, and my belly was flowing just like a river. And immediately speak in tongues. I speak in tongues now. You know,
I speak in tongues too. Super, and if anybody doesn't like it,
yeah,
that's tough.
That's tough.
No, it's kind of a funny thing because I also do. And as soon as I became a Christian, that became real for me. But there are many people that don't get it. But it's fascinating when you describe it as an involuntary thing. In other words, you're not saying, like, I went, you know, and I heard somebody talk about praying in tongues. I said, you want to get filled with the Holy Spirit? You're just telling me you're crying, you go down, somebody prays, and it just happens.
Supernatural. He lays hands on me, the power comes over me, and immediately I start speaking in tongues with power.
And I'm guessing you didn't know what it was.
I had no idea what it was, you know, but I knew my belly was flowing. It was like a river was just gushing through me, And the gentleman picked me up. He said, I don't know who you are, but God has called you.
Is that amazing?
Yeah, and little did I know that God had really called me, because my mother had said, God called you. And my mother was dying, and she said to me one night, I prayed for her. She says, oh, you can pray. She said, but God told me when she was dying, she said, God told me he's going to get it out of you. She said, you're going to go through it, but God says he's going to get it out of you.
Is that amazing? Did you know that your mother was a woman of God before that?
Yes.
You did?
My mother lived a Christian life.
But she didn't drag you to church.
She didn't drag us to church. She didn't make us go to church. It was our choice. But she prayed for all of us.
Yeah.
And the thing about it was her prayers were answered. She prayed to God, save them. She didn't want anything else but us for us to be saved. And here today, you know, I can't describe what God has done in my life, you know, of me preaching the gospel. I'm not qualified. When he called me 9 years ago to preach, I told him, you got the wrong guy. He goes, no, I got the right one. I says, I'm not qualified. He said, no one is qualified. I qualify the call.
Wow. Well, now I don't want to leap ahead too quick, but I love this. So we are... So you're telling me that you have this event. It happens in 1991. What happens after that? Because I know you had a lot of trouble after that. So what happened at that moment? I mean, you know.
What happened after that is I didn't get discipled. Discipleship is so important.
I know.
I mean, I think we don't understand. I think
okay, so,
the churches
so people
don't
know
understand.
What that word means, right? I'm just thinking there's a lot of people listening right now. They don't know what that means. What that means, because the same thing kind of happened to me. It's like you say, okay, God, you're in my life. But then nobody tells you what that means. Nobody tells you what to do, what not to do, how to grow as a Christian. And so you kind of float along and flounder along. And if you're like a normal person, you're going to get back into trouble.
Right.
And that sounds like that's your story.
Well, because discipleship is about the Bible. You know, and the Bible talks about it. It says, my people perish because of lack of knowledge.
Yeah.
No knowledge and understanding of God's word.
Yeah.
We know earthly things, but we don't know kingdom things because we never picked up the book and we never studied it for ourselves. We hear a pastor preach it and wonder how he knows so much. And most of the time, the average person never goes to a Bible study to learn, you know, God's ways and God's commandments.
Yeah.
And that leaves us in the same place. That leaves us in the same familiar place, which the enemy knows, that you don't really know Jesus.
Right.
He knows that you know his name, but you don't know his power. And that's what basically happens to so many of us when we come and have this conversion of Christ, and we never go back, and we wonder why because the enemy knows that if you never pick up that Bible, he knows you're going back to the familiar.
Okay, so you have this experience, you sign a $20 million contract, and you start playing for the Dodgers?
Dodgers,
okay,
LA.
Okay, so you're playing for that. How long were you with the Dodgers?
I was from 91 to 95.
Okay, so during those years, did you have any Christian influence at all in your life?
No, I mean, everything. I really, actually, when I got saved in 91, and I was born again, and the media persecuted me because I was in the same Daryl Strawberry.
Oh, they persecuted you because you were public about it.
Yeah, I went public, and you know I had found Christ.
And they didn't like that.
They didn't like that. They came against me, and I ran into the wall and dislocated my shoulder the first season. And from there, I went back. I went back out because I didn't get discipled. I went back out for probably another 13, 14 years of my life, and I was lost. I was broken. I was left for dead.
When were you? What do you mean you were left for dead?
Well, I mean, I had cancer twice.
So you go So you're not walking with God. You get back into the same old thing. Did you, when you go to play for the Yankees at that time, physically and in terms of your prospects and everything, everything's looking good?
Yeah, when I came back. When I actually came back after playing here in L.A., I went through hell. I got into serious drugs.
Here in L.A.?
Here in L.A., back home, because I knew all the back streets. It was probably the worst decision of my life, leaving New York and coming here. Had nothing to do with the Dodgers.
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm born and raised here in South Central L.A.
Right.
So I knew every back road.
You went back to.
So I went back into, heavy drugs and got lost in drugs.
Now, as an athlete, were you still performing, or did your numbers start to?
I started to really decline.
Yeah.
I started having health issues. You know, like my back went out. I had to have back surgery. And then
what year did the Yankees sign you? 95?
95.
Okay, so when they signed you, were they excited? Where were you in your career at that point?
Because
you
were very excited.
Because you continued to do very well.
I went and played down at well, they signed me in 95, and then they wanted to bring me back in 96, but they didn't. And I figured my career was over by then, so I went and played in St. Paul, Minnesota. For the St. Paul Saints in 96.
Wow.
And,
I missed that.
It was a great time down there. It was a great Mike Vick and Bill Murray and Marv Goldklank, you know, all those guys, you know, and I went down there to play for them. And
yeah,
they kept in touch with George, and George said, can he really play? And that's when I came back. George picked up my contract from there, and I went to the Yankees in 96 and went on to help the Yankees be a part of that 96 run.
Unbelievable. I mean, I didn't think the Yankees would ever lose again. For a few years, it was just on and on and on and on. It was unbelievable.
Well, yeah, we had.
So who's on those teams? I'm trying to remember now.
Jeter was a rookie.
Okay, Jeter was, that's right. That's where he started. That's
he was a rookie. You had O'Neill. You had Tino. You had Bernie. We had Scott Brosius, you know.
Now, Bernie's a Christian, isn't he?
Bernie was Christian. We had Mo Rivera.
Rivera's a Christian.
Yeah, he's a strong Christian. Mo.
Yeah.
He was there. We had a bunch of veteran players that came along. Cecil Field, Tim Raines, myself.
So this has to be when you met my friend B.J. Weber.
I knew B.J. Weber for a long time.
Because B.J. Weber was the chaplain for the Yankees in those years.
Joe Girardi.
What's that?
I met him through
Joe. Joe Girardi, yeah.
Yeah, Joe. And B.J. was the chaplain. He was a super guy. He was always loving. He was always caring, you know, and I just remember him always just saying wonderful things to me. He was somebody that
B.J. Weber started out before he's doing the kind of thing that he was doing with all these sports teams. He started out working in Times Square with the pimps and prostitutes and the drug addicts, and that was his background. And so he's always been able to minister to people with substance abuse. But I guess my question is, were you open about that at the time? That you had substance abuse, or was it you still something you're kind of hiding?
I mean, I was open about it. I mean, mine was already in the public eyes. I already knew I had problems. And substance abuse is, like, really strong, really powerful. Addiction is very powerful. I think people don't understand, and they look at people and say, well, why can't they just stop? It just doesn't work like that. You know, because you don't know the trauma. You don't know what's happened to them, what's affected them on the inside.
Yeah.
Because people that use drugs or drink alcohol consistently like we do, something has happened to you that has made you feel not worthy of your own life, even being a star or whatever it may be. And then you have the average person in America that doesn't have addiction problems,
right?
And they have the same wounds on the inside and can't get well.
Yeah.
So what is it that feels the wounds on the inside? There's only one person can feel them. Only one. We can try everything we want. I can try to be more successful, more money, more fame, more fortune. But it's only one person that can fulfill the brokenness on the inside, and that's Jesus himself. And I think we need to show people that in the society today, because they're looking for everything else to try to make them well. And here's a guy, I tell him all the time, I stand in the pulpit and preach. I've been privileged my whole life. I've lived behind community gates. I've had a bunch of stuff. But I did not become well until I got into a personal relationship with Jesus. When I understand the symbol of the cross and understand the blood and understand his finished work on that, everything that was killing me, he already killed it. So there's victory. There's true victory. And I think so many of us won't receive that.
Have you ever thought of being a preacher?
No, I just like hanging out with
it. It's so interesting because you have lived this. When your worst years, I mean, I remember vaguely, right, that, you know, your name is in the papers because, you know, you picked up a prostitute who ends up being a policewoman. You have everything that you could do wrong, you did. You kept getting in trouble and trouble and trouble. At what point did the Yankees say, we're no longer interested in this franchise called Daryl Strawberry?
Well, the Yankees never said that. George, the boss, never said that.
He never did.
No, he loved me.
So what happened?
He loved me unconditionally. I think Major League Baseball said that's it, you know.
Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I was suspended for that. That was the third time of being suspended.
Because of drugs?
Of drug use, yes. And they banned me for a year, and I just said I'm done. That was it.
What year was that, Daryl?
I knew after the 99 season. After I played on the 99 team and we won, and coming back for the 2000 year, I failed another drug test, and I knew right there that it was over, you know.
Okay, so what at that point in your life, I assume you have money, you are on your second wife?
Second wife.
Was that okay or not?
No, that was I destroyed that too, and I was lost and broken, and I went down a real dark road, and until the third wife, Tracy, came into my life, God used her to lead me back.
What year was that?
That was in like 2003. After I got out of prison, I ended up in a Florida State prison.
You know something? Why did you go to prison?
Addiction. I kept breaking the rules, violation of probation. So I stood in front of the judge and I said, I'd just rather be dead. And she says, well, that's not going to happen. So she kept sending me back to jail. I says, well, they wanted to send me to another treatment center. I said, I don't want to go to treatment anymore. I said, just lock me up. And they sent me to a Florida State prison in Gainesville, and I spent 18 months in the correctional center.
When did you get cancer?
I got cancer in 98 after the 98 season.
I don't want to skip over that. I mean, this is amazing what you have been through, Daryl. You're going through all this stuff. You get cancer.
Twice. 98 season and then the 2000. Then 2000, it reoccurs, and I lose my left kidney in the second surgery. So it was.
You're operating on one kidney now?
Oh, yeah, operating on one kidney, man. God is good. You know, people need to know how God really is.
Okay, you lost a kidney. You lost about 18 inches of colon.
Yes.
That was the second surgery.
That second surgery.
Did you think you might die?
I wanted to.
You wanted to die?
Yes. But God brought Tracy in my life, and she was pulling me out of dope houses in South Florida.
She was pulling you out of dope houses in South Florida?
I was shooting dope and smoking crack.
That woman over there talking to my wife?
Yes.
Now, you met in, she was also in recovery, correct?
Yes. We met at a convention, an NA convention, and she had 1 year clean, and I had like 5 seconds clean. I had just come back from like a 6-day binge of smoking crack, and I was at the convention with some of my sponsees and sponsees brothers, and I met her, and I told her she didn't want. I said, you don't want to get involved with me. I'm dangerous. And she did, and she saw it. She saw how dangerous I really was. I was very sick. And then I started shooting dope and something
so
I had never done.
After you met Tracy, you were still shooting dope.
Yeah, I started shooting dope.
Now, when you say shooting dope, what are we talking about? Heroin?
Heroin.
When you go to that level of shooting heroin, I mean, you hadn't been shooting heroin. What pushes you to that? Is it just still the same pain? You just want to kill the pain?
Yeah, you're still trying to fill the void that's inside, the emptiness on the inside. I think that's why we have such an epidemic today with opiates and heroin addiction, why young people are dying. It's because of the pain that's inside, and they never deal with what happened to them. And Tracy came into my life, and God used her for me to deal with what happened, and I had to deal with it. And once I faced it and dealt with it, and once I went back to my father, who was in the hospital, when the Lord sent me, I was in California to do a men's conference. The Lord sent me to the hospital to go see my father and make me go repent to him.
What year was this?
Somewhere in 2006. Well, after my transformation.
So the transformation, what did that look like? In other words, you meet Tracy. You're still struggling horribly. How does she manage to get you to see something you had not seen in all those years?
Well, because we were together, and then she woke up one day and she says, I don't know what you're going to do, because I was at the bottom. I was $3 million in debt and didn't have a driver's license. We were living in her parents' house. And she woke up one day and said, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to follow Jesus.
Now, had she been a Christian before that?
Well, no, she had just become in a relationship with Christ. She was just starting.
So while you guys were together,
yeah,
she found Jesus.
She found.
And how
Christ.
Did that happen for her?
Well, she got introduced to Jesus through someone in an AA program. A woman brought her. To a Bible study.
Yeah.
And she found the Lord.
Okay, so now she finds the Lord, and now she says, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to follow Jesus.
She said, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm going to follow Jesus. And I said, I don't really know what I'm going to do. I said, I think I'm out of here. I'm going to leave. And she says, I think you need to do that. And I left. I decided to leave. And we broke off the relationship. We didn't know if we were going to be back together or not.
Yeah.
And it was the Lord sent me away for 6 months.
Right.
And I came to California, stayed with my sister and her two kids. And I remember the first night I got to the house, I took my Bible out and was about to open it, got down on my knees. And the Lord said, don't open that Bible. And the Lord said, I've been waiting for you.
Are you serious?
I just lost it. I cried.
I want to ask you, though, because when people say the Lord said, how did you know the Lord said that?
Because I know his voice.
What do you mean you know his voice? You heard a voice.
You know his voice. You know he's the Lord. You know his voice. As a Christian, just because you have not heard from the Lord and you've been born again and you go through some struggles and some time, and when that the Lord finally decides to stop you, he speaks. Okay.
So you're on your knees. The Lord spoke to you.
Oh, he spoke to me.
Why did he tell you not to open the Bible?
Because he said, don't open the Bible. He says, I've been waiting for you. And I just lost it.
It's so amazing to me that God would say that he communicates that so tenderly. It's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
It's his love. I think a lot of times, Eric, what happens to a lot of people is they don't listen. They don't shut their brain off. You know, if you shut your mind off, God is always speaking. But it's those that shut their mind off and listen to what he has to say. And I think a lot of times people don't do that, because you know what I found out by myself why I was never hearing from God? Because I was always too busy. I was always in a hurry to go nowhere. And I think that's what happens to so many of us. We're in a hurry to go nowhere, and we don't spend time with God, because God speaks.
I'm feeling I'm coming under the power of conviction right now, brother. That is, no, what you just said, I mean, it's so obviously true, but it's just interesting the way you just put it. So God speaks to you. I've been waiting for you. This is like 2007, six?
Yeah, five, six.
Someplace in there?
At the beginning of the hour. Beginning of me and Tracy getting back.
Okay, so what happens now?
Well, I lay with him and saturate myself in the Word for 6 months.
Apart from Tracy?
Apart from Tracy, apart from drugs, apart from women, sex, everything. First time in my life I stopped everything for 6 months, and it was just me and God in the Word. And I was going to church two and three times out of the week. I was going to help feed the homeless. He says, get over yourself. Get up. Do something different. I had nothing. 6 months of laying with him in the Word. He started supernaturally. He says, saturate yourself in the Word. The Holy Spirit supernaturally is going to teach you. Then he says, go back and marry Tracy and start. And we started with nothing, me and her. $3 million.
You had less than nothing. $3 million in debt.
I came with $3 million in debt. She goes, you're going to have to clean all this
up. You needed to get $3 million to have nothing. So you get married. Obviously, she's walking with God. It seems to me like at that point, you're good.
No, I mean, it's the process. It's the process of going. When he brought me and Tracy together, he made me sit in the back of the church. Not the front. He said, I want you in the back. He sat me for 7 years because of discipleship. He did not move me for 7 years.
What city were you in?
St. Louis.
So, okay, that's where you are now.
We sat for 7 years. We hid out for 7 years. People were wondering, where is he? What is he doing? And people were contacting other agents, said, well, we want to do a story. We want to do a book. Tracy was like, no, we're not doing stories, books. God's
now,
working on
it. Now, how did you keep it together financially?
I had a little, well, she was worked in real estate. And she had solar houses down in Florida. She had money.
Yeah.
And she had cars. She had everything. So she took care of me.
Yeah. Yeah. The woman right there talking to my wife. It's so great that she's here.
Yeah.
When did you decide this is what I want to do with my life. I want to start a church. Because, again, there are people listening right now, they think of you as, you know, you're a ball player. You, for a number of years with Tracy, have you started a church? You're running a church in the St. Louis area, right?
No, we never started a church.
You never started a church?
I never wanted a church.
But you guys preach.
Yeah, we started doing ministry together.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I never wanted a church. I never felt called to operate a church, because I had been in a lot of churches and I've seen a lot of things.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I decided that's not what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
And I was hoping that God never called me to it.
Yeah.
And Tracy was constantly studying the Word of God. You know, I watched her. She gets up every morning. For 18 years we've been together. I watched her. She gets up every morning at 5:30 and she goes study.
I hate people like that. Tracy, I
know,
hate
me
you.
Too.
I hate you, Tracy. No, that's just...
It's different, you know? And I was always like... I was like... Eric, I was like, God, why are you always speaking to her? And he says, God, you know what God told me? She spends time with me. And I was like, oh, that's the key right there.
Yeah.
Is spending time with him. So guess what? I started staying up late at night, and I started spending the time. And, I mean, supernaturally, the Bible just, poof, started coming alive. And, you know, scriptures supernaturally started retaining inside of me. And I started... You know, speaking a different way and talking about the kingdom and talking about what is souls. And before I knew it, God started sending me this place, that place, and now he sends me everywhere.
I want to ask you, you mentioned the thing with your dad. I can't believe that. After everything you went through with him, you said that God sent you to his hospital bed.
Sent me to his hospital bed and made me repent to him for me keeping him out of my life. God says, how dare you not forgive him, and I forgave you. And I went and repented to him, and my father said, yes. I said, I was wrong. Will you forgive me? He said, yes, and a tear came out of his eye. And I said, I'm sorry for keeping you out of my life for my whole career. And I just lost it. I laid in his lap, cried, just lost it, just sobbing. And then God says, raise up. And I raised up, and God says, lead him to me right now. And there was.
The Lord told you to lead your father to himself.
Yeah. I said, you know, the Lord has changed my life, and I'm a different person. He was like, yeah. I said, would you like to accept him as the Lord of your life? He said, yes. I led him in a sin of prayer to the Lord.
This is called a happy ending, Daryl.
It's a very happy
ending.
That
is so beautiful. I can't believe that. I did not realize this.
Yeah, very happy ending. That's a very happy ending with who God is.
That is so beautiful. Because a lot of people, you know, your parents pass away, you don't get to do that.
Yeah, I was able to do that.
To have that, what a gift from God to you and to your father.
I was able to lead my whole family to the Lord. Outside of my mom, I led my sisters.
Your mom was already there.
Yeah, my mom was already there. My two sisters and my two brothers, God used me to lead them to come back.
Unbelievable.
So I'm forever grateful for grace.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.